content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we're reading this week from the February 1st, 2019 issue of The Week magazine. I always enjoy the cover drawings, but this one really cracks me up. We have Donald Trump and Nancy Pelosi. They're dressed as little kids, and they're on a playground in the sandbox. President Trump has on shorts and a striped T-shirt, and he's playing with a dump truck and a bulldozer, and he's got a shovel. And Nancy Pelosi has on a long sleeve blue dress with polka dot leggings and tennis shoes. And she has just kicked a hole in his sand wall that he's built. And President Trump is crying out just like an offended little kid would. The title is Playground Politics: Why Trump and Pelosi Can't Reach a Deal on the Wall. And that, in fact, is our first main story. Shutdown power struggle escalates. What happened? President Trump's proposal to trade border wall funding for temporary protections for Dreamers appeared dead this week after Democrats rejected his terms and said they would not negotiate until Republicans agreed to end the partial shutdown of the federal government. Trump offered to exchange temporary immigrant protections for $5.7 billion to begin adding steel barriers in high-priority locations to 654 miles of existing border fencing. Those protections included a three-year extension on the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, the DACA program, covering about 700,000 immigrants illegally brought to America as children, the Dreamers. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell called a GOP bill incorporating Trump's proposal a reasonable compromise. "The opportunity to end all this is staring us right in the face," he said. But House Speaker Nancy Pelosi branded Trump's proposal a non-starter because the protections are temporary and attached to new immigration restrictions. She also said Democrats won't negotiate as long as Trump continues the shutdown, which has left 800,000 federal employees without pay. "If Trump can hold the employees hostage now," Pelosi said, "they're hostage forever." As their power struggle escalated, Pelosi told Trump he should postpone next week's scheduled State of the Union address until the shutdown ends. Trump responded with a letter defiantly declaring he would give the annual address in the House as planned, but retreated when Pelosi said he wouldn't be invited. A new Politico Morning Consult poll, meanwhile, found that 54% of voters blamed Trump and congressional Republicans for the shutdown, while 35% blamed the Democrats. With no end to the shutdown in sight, 800,000 federal workers were on the verge of missing a second consecutive paycheck. In San Francisco, 150 Coast Guard families lined up at a food bank for groceries. The FBI agents' union warned the shutdown had stalled major investigations and become a national security threat. Poor, elderly, and disabled tenants residing in federally subsidized housing faced a moratorium on rental vouchers and threats of eviction. As airport security lines grew, a record 10% of TSA agents called in sick on Sunday in apparent protest at not being paid. What the editorial said: Democrats are right to reject Trump's DACA offer, said the Los Angeles Times. The offer of temporary relief wouldn't make the Dreamers much better off than they are now. As the Supreme Court said this week, it wouldn't likely consider their case until 2020. Democrats are also right to refuse to negotiate until the shutdown is over. To do so would be tantamount to encouraging Trump to take the government hostage again the next time he wants something Congress won't give him. Trump's offer of a temporary DACA amnesty was a reasonable proposal, said National Review. And the fact Speaker Pelosi rejected it out of hand is telling. Put simply, she sees no downside to intransigence. Her base fully backs her maximalist position, and the media never call her out. It's clear Trump wants a negotiation, and Pelosi wants a humiliation. What the columnist said. Trump's so-called compromise is a total sham, said Greg Sargent in the Washington Post. First of all, the DACA kids already had legal protection until Trump yanked it away in 2017 by executive order. The Senate bill that incorporated his temporary DACA protection was loaded up with poison pills impossible for Democrats to swallow. In the fine print were provisions banning desperate Central American children from applying for asylum at the border and requiring them to apply in their home countries. It would limit asylum admissions to a tiny 15,000 a year and significantly raise the bar for judging asylum claims, requiring that any approval be in the national interest, a vague term designed to justify mass rejections. Why won't Democrats negotiate? Asked John Fund in NationalReview.com. Simple. Pelosi knows President Trump has been hurt more politically than the Democrats by the government shutdown. And her base, afflicted with Trump derangement syndrome, views him as a devil they must defeat at all costs. That means not even a single nickel for a wall, an unreasonable stance that may soon shift the onus for the shutdown onto Democrats. The American people's patience is running out, said Naomi Lynn and David Chaitin in Washington Examiner. But Trump is no less walled in. Doing nothing is politically untenable, and yet offering even a temporary DACA amnesty leaves his base howling over perceived betrayal. This stalemate could go on for a long time, said Ronald Brownstein in CNN.com. This power struggle is not really about a literal wall anymore, but the powerful symbol it's become. Older and rural Americans want the government to halt or at least slow the country's growing ethnic and racial diversity. Progressives see the wall as a symbol of racism. Sadly, the wall proposed as a barrier between America and Mexico has been transformed into a metaphorical one rising on the fault line separating blue from red America. Our controversy of the week is titled Standoff on the Mall. What do the videos actually reveal? At first, it looked like the clearest cut case of good versus evil one could ever imagine, said Daniel McCarthy in Spectator.us. In a brief video clip that went viral this week, an old and frail Native American man stands on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, surrounded by jeering white teenagers in red Make America Great Again hats, one of whom stands only inches from the man's face, grinning in silent insult. The outrage online was swift. Social media lit up with calls from liberals for the teen villain to be identified, expelled, and shunned for life as a racist pariah. And the boys' high school, Covington Catholic in Kentucky, issued a formal apology. And then came the context, said David Brooks in New York Times. A longer video was released that shows the Covington group enduring prolonged racial and sexual slurs from a nearby group of Hebrew Israelite black separatists before the indigenous elder, 64-year-old Marine veteran Nathan Phillips, inexplicably marches into the teenagers' midst and starts banging a tribal drum only inches from the face of a kid who later identified himself as 11th grader Nick Sandman. Phillips, in other words, was the aggressor, not the victim. And the demonization of the preppy red-headed Sandman, assumed to be a racist oppressor, was a blatant rush to judgment. The additional video footage does add some complexity, said Ruth Graham in Slate.com, but it doesn't exonerate the kids in the red caps. The extended footage actually shows some of the teens performing tomahawk chops, dancing and sneeringly mimicking Phillips' Native American chanting. At best, that's offensive. At worst, racist. And although Sandman released a statement, written by a public relations firm his parents hired, insisting he'd been silently praying and trying to defuse the situation, the sneering privilege of his smirk and red MAGA cap as he blocked Phillips' path tell a different story. Don't doubt what you saw with your own eyes, said Laura Wagner in Deadspin.com. An elderly member of one of America's most marginalized communities was taunted and mocked by a writhing mass of sneering young white men clad in the racist, misogynist paraphernalia of our toxic president. The MAGA caps definitely shaped how people perceived the confrontation, said Megan McArdle in the Washington Post. But can we reasonably find Sandman and the other Covington kids guilty of any real offense, besides being rambunctious teenagers? Watch all 90-plus minutes of available video, and you will count maybe three half-hearted tomahawk chops performed by a handful of students. As for Sandman's famous smirk, said Kyle Smith in NationalReview.com, precisely what facial expression would we have a high school junior adopt when a strange adult deliberately invades his personal space and starts loudly banging a drum in his face? This incident has quickly become a political Rorschach test, said Julie Zimmerman in TheAtlantic.com. Based on whether you see Phillips or Sandman as the victim, I can probably tell you where you live, who you voted for in 2016, and your general take on a list of other issues. That's a sad statement about how utterly polarized we've become. We're living through an American Rashomon, said Tony Norman in the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. The haunting image of a white kid in a MAGA cap locking eyes with a Native American perfectly captures today's messy, divisive, dispiriting, and thoroughly humiliating American reality. What people see in that image reveals more about their biases than about objective truth. Time for our Good Week, Bad Week segment. It was a good week for idle hands after Pornhub, the streaming pornography service, announced a 6.3% increase in traffic from the Washington, D.C. metro area during the ongoing government shutdown. It was a good week for respect after an Iowa man who won a single dollar from a scratch-off lottery ticket requested and received his winnings in the form of a giant novelty check. Winner Tyler Heap says that after the presentation ceremony at Iowa Lottery headquarters, he promptly blew his windfall on a half a gallon of gas. And it was a good week for passive aggression after Louisiana Family Eye Care offered to gladly provide no-cost eye exams to all NFL officials so other football fans don't feel our pain. A blown pass interference call in last week's NFC Championship game cost the New Orleans Saints a place in the Super Bowl. It was a bad week for British eels, who are becoming hyperactive because of urinated cocaine entering the River Thames through the sewage system, according to new research. Scientists estimate about 80,000 lines of cocaine are entering the Thames per day. It was a bad week for ambiance, with KFC's launch of a limited edition gravy-scented candle. The artisanal candle supposedly replicates the familiar and evocative aroma of KFC's signature gravy, a scent the company described as staggeringly nose-stimulating. And finally, it was a bad week for wishful thinking after Fox and Friends, President Trump's favorite TV show, briefly posted a picture of liberal Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, captioned with the text, 1933 to 2019, suggesting she had died. Fox blamed a technical error. Our briefing page article this week is titled CBD Mania. The cannabis extract is being hailed as a miracle drug. Is there any evidence that it works? What is it? Cannabidiol, or CBD, is a compound, the cannabis sativa plant, that doesn't get you high. THC is the psychoactive component in marijuana that makes people euphoric. CBD has exploded in popularity over the past year because it's been purported to do just about everything: relieve pain, reduce anxiety and stress, and treat inflammation, insomnia, headaches, hangovers, nausea, skin disorders, joint pain, muscle spasms, and period cramps. When ingested, CBD affects cannabinoid receptors throughout the body, which have a regulatory function. CBD products were once limited to medical marijuana shops, but now those made from hemp, marijuana's low THC cousin, are available online and in health food stores, supermarkets, and even gas stations. Next year, nationwide sales are expected to soar to $22 billion by 2022. Following endorsements from such celebrities as Jennifer Aniston, Joe Rogan, and wellness tycoon Gwyneth Paltrow, CBD was destigmatized seemingly overnight. CBD is the chemical equivalent of Bitcoin in 2016, New York advertising executive Jason DeLand said. It's hot everywhere, and yet almost nobody understands it. How is it ingested? Some puff it from a vaporizer, but it's mainly produced as an oil concentrate, allowing it to be mixed in juice or other liquids and consumed by drinking. It's also been blended into bath bombs, lotions, and ointments as a topical treatment, and added to nearly every food imaginable, from ice cream and smoothies to gumdrops and salad dressing. A ritzy New York hotel offers all CBD room service menu. Meatballs and tater tots are bestsellers. And for a few extra bucks, cafes across the country will add a shot of it to your latte. Last summer, stoner icon Willie Nelson began selling Willie's Remedy, a CBD-infused coffee, and major companies such as Coca-Cola are rumored to be considering bringing CBD beverages to the mass market. So it's legal? It's actually in a gray area. The Food and Drug Administration still classifies CBD made from the marijuana plant as a Schedule I substance, along with drugs like heroin and LSD. Just one CBD-based pharmaceutical, Epidiolex, which treats rare forms of pediatric epilepsy, is FDA-approved, and it's illegal for CBD products to advertise medical benefits. Nonetheless, many small shops and online retailers sell hemp-derived CBD in states where marijuana is banned. The legality of CBD got a big boost in December when President Trump signed the 2018 Farm Bill, which legalized commercialized hemp production. It had been outlawed in 1937. Hemp is a cannabis plant that contains less than 0.3% of the psychoactive compound THC and has been used for millennia in food and to make products like rope, paper, and textiles. The new law did not explicitly legalize hemp-derived CBD, but opened the door for the burgeoning market to become federally regulated. How will that help? Without regulation, CBD products are marketed and labeled about as reliably as snake oil. A 2017 University of Pennsylvania study examined 84 CBD products and found that nearly 70% were mislabeled. 40% had significantly more CBD than advertised, while about a quarter of them had significantly less. Dosage recommendations wildly vary. Alarmingly, about 20% of the products contained a significant amount of THC, which would show up on a drug test. It really is the Wild West, said Marcel Bond Miller, the professor who led that study. Joe Bob, who starts up a CBD company, could say whatever the hell he wants on a label and sell it to people. Is CBD backed by science? Most findings are preliminary at best, since research on CBD itself began only a few years ago. Studies on both animals and humans so far have found some evidence it might alleviate psychotic disorders, lessen anxiety, relieve mild or moderate pain, and reduce insomnia. As for cosmetic claims, one study found CBD reduced visible signs of aging in mice. Scientists say, however, that high-quality, double-blind clinical trials on humans need to be conducted to verify CBD's purported benefits. There's also uncertainty about proper dosage levels, CBD side effects, and how CBD products interact with other drugs. Where do the experts stand? Research may be sparse, but unlike, say, crystals and healing bracelets, CBD clearly does have biological effects. I think there is a legitimate medicine here, said CNN chief medical correspondent Dr. Sanjay Gupta, a neurosurgeon. We're talking about something that could really help people. That said, there is plenty of skepticism that CBD is a magical elixir. There's an enormous placebo effect, said Dr. Margaret Haney, director of Columbia University's Marijuana Research Laboratory. If you go in with this expectation, with all of society saying this will cure whatever ails you, it often will. Some call CBD the new avocado toast, a fad for wellness obsessives. But DeLand, the ad exec, believes that CBD's benefits will be confirmed or debunked before too long. The future of this industry, he said, is going to be based on fact, not fiction. And we'll read a few of the best columns of the week, starting with the left's acceptance of anti-Semitism. The left has a growing anti-Semitism problem, said Abe Greenwald. Several newly elected House Democrats are poised to become extraordinarily effective ambassadors for this poisonous ideology. Minnesota Representative Ihan Omar, a Muslim immigrant, was just appointed to the House Foreign Affairs Committee despite her support for the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Campaign, BDS, aimed at destroying Israel. Omar has both defended and apologized for her 2012 tweet that said, "Israel has hypnotized the world. May Allah awaken the people and help them see the evil doings of Israel." On the day she was sworn in, Michigan Representative Rashida Tlaib dined with an Hezbollah supporter who's railed against criminal Zionists. Anti-Semitism is also infusing the activist left. Last week's Women's March was roiled by controversy after its organizers refused to disavow Nation of Islam leader Louis Farrakhan, an outspoken anti-Semite, who has condemned the satanic Jew. The New Left believes Jews are too powerful and too white to be the targets of bigotry. Calls for Israel's destruction are excused as long as the critics are women or people of color. Mainstream Democrats act as if this were a mere matter of bad optics, in effect, covering it up. This column is from Belgium. The young demand a future. Belgium's youth are rising up in rage, said Francis van der Woolstein. We old folks have dismissed the current generation as self-centered, only interested in video games and posting selfies on Instagram. But the children of the year 2000, those just now reaching adulthood, are as politically aware as the generation of 1968, and they have a righteous cause. These kids have grown up with the knowledge that they were born into a polluted, depleted world where climate change could soon render life hellish for millions. And they won't stand for it. 2 weeks ago, the burgeoning Belgian youth movement brought 3,000 striking students into the streets. By last week, their number had grown to 12,000. How many will it be next week? The movement is already spreading to Switzerland. And unlike the Yellow Vest movement in France, where adults are rioting over taxes, these young people are peaceful and selfless, but radical. They demand nothing less than a total overhaul of the global economy, and they're right. We've been offering our children kiwis from New Zealand and strawberries from Ethiopia, when what they really need is a clean planet and breathable air. Will they change the world? Somebody has to. And this is from South Korea, a bullying epidemic among nurses. Young nurses are still being hazed to death despite a government pledge to stamp out the practice, said the Dong Ah Ilbo in an editorial. Last February, South Koreans learned of the extent of the practice of taeum, in which senior nurses harass and berate rookies after the suicide of one victim. Other nurses spoke out, telling of being belittled, mocked, yelled at, and ordered to go home early. So the health ministry took action, saying it would revoke the license of any doctor or nurse who bullied an incoming nurse, and would establish a nurse human rights center where victims could report harassment and receive counseling. But nearly a year later, little has improved at nurses' workplaces. The legislation required to legalize license revocation is stalled in a parliamentary committee, and no new nurses' rights center has been set up. Meanwhile, nursing departments are chronically understaffed, and Korean nurses are each expected to take care of more than four patients, twice as many as their American and Japanese counterparts. Lack of nursing staff leads to poor working conditions, which in turn spawns the culture of bullying. But who would want this job? Just last week, another nurse, only 20 years old, took her own life, and authorities again suspect hazing. Our in-depth article this week is titled Inconvenient Truths. Forensic pathologist Bennett Omalu shook the NFL with his findings about traumatic brain injury, said Gabriel Thompson. Now he's upending California law enforcement with his findings about police violence. Bennett Omalu is not a man who seeks out controversy. He's been known to flee it, in fact. But it has a way of finding him. Last March, 22-year-old Stephen Clark became the latest flashpoint in the ongoing national furor over the police use of force against African Americans. After the unarmed black man was shot and killed by Sacramento police officers in the backyard of his grandmother's house, Black Lives Matter activists led a march that shut down Interstate 5 and forced the cancellation of a Sacramento Kings NBA game. A week after the shooting, during a game between the Kings and the Boston Celtics, both teams wore jerseys with Clark's name and the words "Accountability" and "We Are One" on them during warm-ups and the playing of the national anthem. Soon after Clark's death, his family contacted Omalu, a forensic pathologist, and asked him to perform a private autopsy. On March 30th, Omalu released his findings. He determined that Clark had been shot 8 times and that 6 of the bullets had entered the back of his body. This cast doubt on the veracity of the police report, which stated that Clark had been approaching the officers when they fired. In response to what the county coroner called the erroneous information provided by Omalu, the following day the county released its official autopsy, which found that Clark had been shot 7 times, only 3 times in the back. A soft-spoken, devoutly Catholic, 50-year-old forensic pathologist from Nigeria is not exactly the first person you'd expect to keep materializing at the center of major American controversies involving contested deaths and charges of official cover-ups. Yet Omalu has now played a leading role in 3 such scandals, including the mother of all sports medicine train wrecks, the National Football League concussion debacle. For a man who became a forensic pathologist in part because, he says, it placed me as far away as possible from living, breathing patients while still allowing me to practice medicine, Omalu has had a career and a life crowded with high-pressure human interaction. He grew up in a village in southern Nigeria during the Biafran War. His family was displaced, and his father was almost killed at a checkpoint manned by militiamen hostile to his Igbo tribe. He earned his medical degree, but suffered from depression and desperately wanted to get out of corruption-riddled Nigeria, where he once watched a patient die in a hospital because the surgeon on duty inexplicably refused to operate. In 1994, Omalu managed to obtain a coveted visa and immigrated to the United States to study cancer epidemiology at the University of Washington. Omalu venerated the United States as a place that sets you free to be whatever you want to be. But in Seattle, he learned about its darker side. Employees followed him in the grocery store, and police repeatedly stopped him as he walked through his mostly white neighborhood. Omalu didn't understand what was going on. "I thought there was something wrong with me," he says, until his landlady suggested that he go to the Liberty and read up on the U.S. history. Go to the library and read up on U.S. history. "Slavery, ah, civil rights, ah," Omalu says. After Seattle, Omalu did a residency in clinical and anatomical pathology at Columbia University, then completed several fellowships and earned master's degrees in public health and business administration at other universities. His curriculum vitae runs to 32 pages. He was determined that his skin color would not hold him back, and he regarded education as the key. "I may have overcompensated," he jokes. Omalu produced his forensic masterpiece in 2002 as an unknown pathologist in the coroner's office in Allegheny County, Pennsylvania. One day, he was assigned to perform an autopsy on the brain of former Pittsburgh Steelers center Mike Webster, and he discovered that it was riddled with lesions, the first diagnosed case in an NFL player of what he would come to call chronic traumatic encephalopathy, CTE. Additional research confirmed his hypothesis. The repeated blows to the head suffered by most football players puts them at risk for serious brain damage. During a long and torturous process that culminated in a class action lawsuit brought by 20,000 former NFL players, and the league finally admitting that there was a link between football and CTE and creating a $765 million fund to help deal with the problem, Umalu became a hot commodity. Journalists sought him out for quotes, and job offers came in from all over the country. But there were just as many negatives. Strange cars began following him. Other scientists took credit for his discovery. Battered and overwhelmed, Umalu fell into a deep depression. "I wish I had never met Mike Webster," he told himself. At this moment, an unlikely escape hatch opened. Out in California, an official at San Joaquin General Hospital began wooing him to be the county's chief forensic pathologist. Umalu and his Kenyan-born wife, Prima, were flown out and given tours of San Francisco, Sacramento, and Napa Valley. Worried about her husband's depression and smitten with the idea of a move west, Prima urged Umalu to take the job. He did, and in 2007 they moved with their son to Lodi, the mid-sized city north of Stockton that is surrounded by farmland. It felt like the middle of nowhere, which was just what they were looking for. He and his family soon fell in love with the San Joaquin County. "Lower profile, no NFL presence," Umalu says, "I just wanted out. A lot of people think I want attention. I don't. I was running away from it." He didn't realize he was about to find himself involved in another high-profile controversy. Umalu's new boss was the sheriff of San Joaquin County, a bow-tie-wearing department veteran named Steve Moore. The system Umalu would be working in, called a sheriff-coroner system, is highly unusual. In Pennsylvania, Umalu had worked within the far more common medical examiner system, in which physicians, often board-certified in forensic pathology, declare the manner of death. Only in California, South Dakota, Montana, and Nevada can the person who makes that determination also be the county's top law enforcement officer. In a sheriff-coroner system, a forensic pathologist like Umalu is responsible only for determining the medical cause of death, such as asphyxiation or blunt force trauma. The far more legally consequential manner of death, accident, homicide, or suicide, is ruled on by the sheriff, although the medical official also issues a recommendation. The potential conflict of interest is obvious. When a person dies in police custody, should the sheriff be the one investigating the death? Umalu's first major problem with Moore began in the summer of 2008, after the body of Daniel Lee Humphreys was wheeled into the morgue. The 47-year-old had crashed his motorcycle on Interstate 5 while fleeing from a California Highway Patrol officer, then attempted to climb the median that divided the freeway, whereupon the officer had shocked him with a taser. According to newspaper reports, Humphreys' ex-wife was told that the CHP officer had discharged his taser twice. When a taser is used, the sheriff's office is required to create a printout documenting its use. Umalu waited 6 months for the printout, but it didn't arrive. At that point, and without more information to guide his autopsy, he examined Humphreys' preserved brain and found that he had suffered a mild traumatic brain injury, a concussion, which in rare cases can lead to death. He concluded that Humphreys' death had likely been caused by head injury suffered during the crash. It wasn't until 2 years later that Umalu finally obtained the taser printout from an assistant district attorney. It had been created the day after the incident, and it showed that Humphreys had been shocked 31 times over a period of more than 7 minutes. Umalu revised his autopsy. He now found that Humphreys had been killed by repeated conducted electrical excitation. He also changed his recommendation concerning the manner of the death from accident to homicide. Despite the new information, Sheriff Moore continued to classify the death as an accident. Omalu was angered by this and, in a larger sense, by what he considered Moore's dictatorial tendencies. He also balked at the county's practice of removing the hands of corpses to identify individuals, which Omalu considered unnecessary and, as he later wrote, a form of body mutilation. But he remained in his post, convinced that his prime responsibility was to protect the autopsy, as he told me. Omalu is not a particularly modest man, and he was certain that he could slowly change the culture of the sheriff coroner's office from within. All that changed in 2016. Three people in San Joaquin County died while being arrested by police. And in two of the cases, Omalu and Moore again clashed. The first case in March involved a man named Albalino Cordova Cuevas. What happened between Cordova Cuevas and the arresting officer is disputed. The Stockton Police Department claims that after a traffic stop, the 28-year-old ran from his vehicle and fought with officers, which led them to use a chokehold and a taser to subdue him. An attorney representing the family of Cordova Cuevas, citing witnesses, claims that the man's hands were up in surrender and that he told officers he didn't have a weapon. Omalu judged the death a homicide caused by asphyxiation, compression of the neck, and blunt force trauma to the head, face, neck, and trunk. But Moore's office ignored his recommendation and concluded that the death was an accident. Omalu began documenting his meetings with Moore in memos. In my mind, Omalu wrote in one, he seems to believe that every officer involved death should be ruled an accident because the police did not mean to kill anyone. What he had once considered an anomaly had become routine practice, he noted. In November 2017, Omalu's colleague, Susan Parson, resigned, motivated in part by what she described as Moore's intrusion into physician independence. Parson had come to the sheriff coroner's office in 2016 for the chance to work with Omalu, but she had an adversarial relationship with Moore, who she felt tried to control her every move. And over the summer, she had filed a gender harassment complaint against Moore's office. Several days later, Omalu resigned as well. The pair released to the press more than 100 pages of memos in which they described what they considered to be gross incompetence and interference on the part of Moore and his staff. Moore vigorously disputes every one of Omalu's allegations. Asked about the missing taser printout, Moore's office replied, neither the sheriff nor chief deputy coroner was aware of the printout until Dr. Omalu provided the information. Moore also strongly denies that he ever attempted to influence Omalu's findings. In March 2018, as Moore came under increasing scrutiny, his office reclassified the death of Cordova Cuevas as a homicide. In April, the county released an independent audit of the sheriff coroner's office, spurred by the resignations. The office must be and appear to be independent of law enforcement, particularly when investigating deaths in the custody of law enforcement or while in jail prison, the auditor wrote. This requires a complete shift toward a medical examiner system. Next month, the county supervisors unanimously endorsed such a shift. In June, Moore, a three-time incumbent, faced a retired deputy sheriff named Pat Withrow, whose campaign highlighted Omalu's resignation. In an upset, Withrow defeated Moore by 17 points. Omalu's resignation made waves. The most consequential outcome beyond Moore's ouster was Senate Bill 1303, which would require California counties with populations greater than 500,000 to adopt a medical examiner system. Omalu worked hard to get it passed, but it was ultimately vetoed by Governor Jerry Brown, whose office issued a boilerplate statement that such decisions were best left to local jurisdictions. All you can do is your best, says Omalu. His name is a shortened version of his father's surname, Onyemalukube. In Igbo, the language spoken by Omalu's ancestral tribe in southern Nigeria, it means, if you know, come forth and speak. This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in San Francisco Magazine. Read one of the obituaries for you this week. The Broadway star who was the definitive Dolly. Carol Channing, 1921 to 2019. Carol Channing was an inimitable and unstoppable Broadway force for more than seven decades. Standing 6 feet in stockings with saucer-wide eyes, an elastic smile, and a voice that could shift from a growl to a squeak, the actress first dazzled audiences in 1949 as Lorelei Lee, an innocent gold digger from Little Rock, Arkansas, in the original production of Gentlemen Prefer Blondes. But the role that would define her came in 1964, when she appeared as the sweet, scheming matchmaker Dolly Gallagher Levi in Hello, Dolly. Channing would play Dolly more than 5,000 times on the Great White Way and on tour, and nothing could keep her from the limelight. Over the years, she appeared on stage in a sling, a neck brace, and a wheelchair. "Don't worry about learning the part," Channing would tell understudies. "You'll never have to go on." Raised in San Francisco in a devout Christian Scientist household, Channing discovered her calling as a girl while delivering copies of the Christian Science Monitor to a theater, said HuffingtonPost.com. "This is a temple," she recalled thinking. "I stood there and wanted to kiss the floorboards." Channing briefly studied drama and dance at Bennington College in Vermont before heading to New York City to pursue acting. She worked as a bit player and nightclub impressionist and took jobs as a model, receptionist, and sales clerk during lean times, said the Associated Press. After being cast in Blondes, Channing's stardom was guaranteed. One critic hailed her Lee as the most fabulous comic creation of this dreary period in history. And the show gave Channing an unforgettable signature song, "Diamonds Are a Girl's Best Friend." The debut of Hello, Dolly was greeted with rave reviews, and the show won 10 Tony Awards, including one for Channing as Best Actress in a Musical. Her vivacious personality didn't translate to the big screen. She looked almost manic in 1967's Thoroughly Modern Millie, and she appeared in few movies, said the Daily Telegraph. The theater remained her true home, and Dolly her favorite role. She played the part for the final time on Broadway in 1995, at the age 74, and then headed off on a worldwide tour with the production. "Performing is the only excuse for my existence," she said that year. "What can be better than this?" We'll read a couple of the health and science articles this week. Health in particular. First, fiber's many benefits. In a blow to proponents of low-carbohydrate diets, a landmark study has found that people who eat more fiber, found in fruit, vegetables, and whole grain cereals, pasta, and bread, are less likely to die early or suffer from chronic conditions such as cardiovascular disease or cancer. An international team of researchers commissioned by the World Health Organization analyzed more than 180 studies and 50 clinical trials from the past 40 years. They found that people who ate the most fiber were 15 to 30% less likely to die prematurely than those who ate the least. Those heavy fiber consumers were also 16 to 24% less likely to suffer a stroke or develop heart disease, type 2 diabetes, or colorectal cancer. The optimal fiber intake, researchers determined, was 25 to 29 grams a day. American adults consume an average of 15 grams. The study is a defining moment in dietary fiber research, co-author John Cummings of the University of Dundee tells TheGuardian.com. We need to get this written in stone and part of people's lives. We'll follow that with the health scare of the week, sleep loss and heart disease. A terrible night's sleep isn't just bad for your mood. It could also damage your heart, according to a new Spanish study. Researchers recruited nearly 4,000 people with an average age of 46 and no known history of heart disease, and for 7 nights had them wear a small device that measures the length and quality of sleep. The participants also had a cardiac CT scan and 3D ultrasounds of their hearts and arteries at the start and end of the study. After factoring out other risk factors for heart disease, the team found that people who slept for fewer than 6 hours a night were 27% more likely to have atherosclerosis, the buildup of plaque in the body's arteries, a common cause of heart attacks and strokes, than those who slept 7 to 8 hours. Those who woke often during the night or who struggled to doze off were 34% more likely to have the condition than those who got a good night's snooze. We have to include sleep as one of the weapons we use to fight heart disease, lead researcher Jose Ordovas tells USA Today. It's a factor we are compromising every day. And we'll move right on to the Talking Points page with a short article titled, Trump's Presidency, a Two-Year Report Card. Donald Trump's presidency is now officially 2 years old, said Max Boot in the Washington Post. It's time to take stock. Sure, conservatives can cheer tax cuts, deregulation, and 85 judicial appointments, but at what cost? The dominant themes of this presidency are four bleak words: racism, authoritarianism, incompetence, megalomania. Trump has fawned over dictators and, worse, emulated their example. He's praised neo-Nazis as very fine people, demeaned dark-skinned people from shithole countries, locked up Central American kids, and injected a strain of racism into American public discourse that was formerly exiled to the lunatic fringe. The damage this crude con man has done to our nation is deep, said David Ferris in TheWeek.com, and it's bound to get worse. Trump has dismantled the post-World War II order, needlessly alienating our allies, run up a $1 trillion deficit in a time of prosperity, persuaded millions of Americans to scorn science, journalism, and objective truth itself, and taught the world America's word is no longer to be trusted. Something about America as an idea has been obliterated. Trump's supporters would vehemently disagree, said Charlotte Allen in USA Today. In 2 short years, he's smashed ISIS, put an embassy in Jerusalem, overseen a booming economy, kept the migrant caravan from crossing the border, and brought the Chinese to the negotiating table with tough tariffs. And he didn't blink when Democrats tried to derail Brett Kavanaugh's nomination with outlandish allegations. I give him an A-. Trump recorded these victories and others despite a historically unprecedented volume of attacks and hostility, said Michael Glassner in FoxNews.com. 90% of the media's coverage of him has been negative. Activist liberal judges have thwarted his agenda. Democrats spin conspiracy theories about Russian collusion. The D.C. establishment has deployed every weapon in its arsenal. It still hasn't been enough to stop Trump. No matter how you view Trump's first 2 years, said Alex Shepard in the New Republic, the outlook for the remainder of his term is grim. The economy is slowing and may be headed for a recession. Polls show Trump's approval rating sinking into the 30s, with even some Republicans peeling off. House Democrats will soon start investigations, and Special Counsel Robert Mueller's report is coming. In the next 2 years, truly anything can happen. Prepare for the worst. And a couple of short notes here. President Trump hasn't vetoed a single bill since he took office. The last president not to veto any legislation was James Garfield, who served less than a year before being assassinated in 1881. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell won't allow a vote on any legislation Trump doesn't support. Americans are now more likely to die of an opioid overdose than in a car accident, a fall, or a shooting. A new report from the National Safety Council found that, based on 2017 data, Americans have a 1 in 96 chance of dying from an opioid overdose, including heroin and fentanyl, while the probability of dying in a motor vehicle crash is 1 in 103. About 70% of high school valedictorians in recent years have been girls. And we'll finish out with a quote from writer Matt Haig, quoted in the New York Times. He says, "Never worry what the cool people think. Head for the warm people. Life is warmth. You'll be cool when you're dead." And with that, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call, 919-832-5138.